We are continuing in our series on the nuclear family, and we're looking at the powerful influence a family can have when it lives a gospel-centered life. Last week we began our study of a particular nuclear family in the Bible, the extended family of Abraham. And there again, you can see four generations from Abraham's family tree as chronicled in Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 50. And several of you, by the way, asked for a copy of this diagram. You can find it on Riverview's Facebook page, or if you have your web-enabled device, we posted it there for you as well. And we're looking at how did their specific family apply or ignore the gospel principles that Noel shared with us in the first 4 weeks of this series, and also how did God use them in the midst of that to influence the world? And we asked ourselves this question last week. The question was, how do you typically respond when things do not go your way? See, Abraham's family was a normal family. Just like any other family, they faced challenges that tested their faith, and they struggled to figure out how to navigate those difficult situations. And so they developed, like all families, default responses. Like we talked about last week with computers. Computers, when something goes wrong, they have a default that they go to every time unless the operator overrides that decision. And it's the same way with us. We develop those typical sort of standard responses inside of our families. And last week we examined one of the patterns that developed in Abraham's family, the pattern of jealousy. And remember, it started with Hagar's look that she gave Sarah, and then it just mushroomed out of control all the way through. It went kind of viral through their family to the point where family members were being threatened and sold into slavery, and it was this destructive force. And yet in the midst of their jealous mess, we found hope. I think in two ways. First, there is hope in the fact that we don't have to continue the destructive patterns that were passed on to us. They can be stopped. Joseph says, let's put an end to this way of doing things in our family, and sort of ends the pattern of jealousy. And then the bigger hope is in the fact that despite this really a sin issue that just went right through their family, God still was able to use Abraham's family to literally save the world two different times. And our hope is that our families would have that same kind of impact on the world around us. Now, not everyone in Abraham's family had jealousy as one of their default responses when they were faced with difficult circumstances. And so today we're going to look at how deception became a different response that other people in their family used when they got stressed, when things didn't go their way. Now, think back to the game that we just played for a moment. Words are like the toothpaste inside of the tube. It's much easier to get them out than it is to get them back in. Much easier. And that's especially true with harmful words, destructive words. They have this sort of expanding property. They just grow once they're out there. How many of you have ever said something, and the moment that it came out, the first thing you can think about is how badly you wish you could just grab it and stuff it back where it came from and hope that no one ever heard it in the first place? But it doesn't work like that, right? Once it's out there, as you saw, trying to get it back in usually just makes things messier. I found this real simple definition of deception that I like. It says the deliberate misrepresentation of the truth. Deception is the deliberate misrepresentation of the truth. In other words, it's not a miscommunication or a misunderstanding or a mistake. Those things are unintentional. Deception is deliberate. In other words, the hearer understands something that's not true because that's exactly what the communicator intends for them to hear. Whether they admit it or not, the intent is to deceive, to mislead. It could be something that we say. When we say something deceptive, that's called a a lie. It's just a flat-out lie. I'm just intending to use words that aren't true. I want to mislead. It could be something that we don't say, that we choose to omit from a conversation, but we know that it's making somebody believe something that's not really true. It could be something that we allow other people to understand or to believe. We can deceive ourselves. We can deceive each other. And I think the deception, the temptation to deceive, goes all the way back to the fact that we're sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. They were deceived, and they chose to respond by being deceptive. It's not something that we necessarily receive from our parents, the temptation to be deceptive. I mean, I was an extremely deceptive kid growing up. I stacked lies on top of one another and manipulated and maneuvered to the point where I honestly, a lot of times, didn't even know what was true anymore. But it's not something my parents taught me. It's not like they came along and said, hey, James, I want to tell you, when you get old, you know, when you start growing up, think you get afraid or you start, you know, I want you to just start lying and then just keep going and just let it get out of control. They never said that to me. And the same thing is true with my own kids. I don't think my wife, Laura, is teaching them that when they get jammed up, you know, be a deceiver. Dude, no. But the temptation, it's just part of our sin nature. And yet the Bible speaks out and warns against deception, which means it's not something that we have to do. Rather, it's a choice that we choose to make, like happened in the story of Adam and Eve. It's all over the Bible. Remember, we looked last week at jealousy, how that's in the Ten Commandments. Deception is there too in Exodus 20. You shall not bear false witness. Throughout the Psalms and the Proverbs, there are frequent warnings and teachings about deception. We see throughout the Old Testament specific people who practice deception and then the negative consequences that they face. And then on into the New Testament, we see in passages like Ephesians chapter 4 and 1 John and James chapter 2 and chapter 3. There's just a ton. The consistency of the teaching in the Bible shows us that this is a really, really big deal. In fact, Satan himself in the Bible, he is not referred to as the father of hate or the father of anger or the father of jealousy. He's referred to as the father of lies, the deceiver. I think deception is also like jealousy in that ultimately it is a faith issue. I found this quote by a French person that I cannot begin to pronounce this name, but the quote is good. It says, lying is a terrible vice. It testifies that one despises God, but fears men. In other words, I don't trust Jesus to protect me, so I use deception to protect myself. I'm not comfortable with who Jesus has made me to be, so I pretend like I'm someone else. Or I commit a sin and I don't really believe that Jesus' death on the cross is enough to cover my sin. So I lie so that I can cover it up myself. And we don't even really need the Bible to tell us that deception has this expanding property, right? It's like a weed. Maybe you've heard the famous quotation from Sir Walter Scott. He said, what a tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive. That's right. It's like being snared in a spider's web. The more we struggle, the more tangled up we become. See, I think we believe oftentimes that deception will protect us, but instead it just makes things more complicated in our lives. And as long as we stay committed to deception, the situation just gets worse. And that's exactly what happens in Abraham's family. And this time, if you remember with jealousy, it was Sarah who planted the seed in their family. But with this case, with deception, it actually was Abraham. Abraham wasn't the jealous type, but one of his default responses here was deception. And we're going to pick it up in Genesis chapter 12, if you've got your Bible or you want to follow along on the screen, starting with verse 10. It says, now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarah, I know what a beautiful woman you are. That's a good opening line with Sarah right there. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake and my life will be spared because of you. Now, as you might recall from last week, we talked about how God made this series of specific promises to Abraham about his future. In fact, in this very chapter, chapter 12 that we just read from, he clarified those promises about who his descendants will be and the land they were going to inherit. And yet Abraham gets out into the culture and he's unprepared for this conversation, for this situation. See, if he truly trusted God, he shouldn't have been afraid for his life. I don't know if you see that. Because what did God promise him? You're going to have descendants that number more than the stars in the sky. They didn't even have any kids yet. There was no reason for him to be afraid for his life. And yet, he gets afraid. And I think most of the time, we're going to see this in this story, and I think for most of us, deception is fear-driven. And that's his first reaction, is just to lie. And here's the deception. He asks his wife to pretend she's somebody that she's not. I want you to be a person that you're not really. And I want you to tell people that lie. And I think that's so often what happens to us as Christians when we engage the culture, is we end up with this sort of pretending. And the culture hates it. Our culture is kind of weird in that way, that we push and bait people towards being deceptive, and then when they do, then we point and go, ha-ha, see, you should have never done that. Right? And I have found, in my experience, that people who aren't yet believers in Jesus, the biggest issue they struggle with folks who are believers in Jesus, is this sort of hypocrisy, this sort of two-faced kind of thing that goes on. In fact, that's exactly what happens here in the story with Pharaoh and the Egyptians. When they find out that Abraham and Sarah are lying to them, they're shocked and they're angry. Why didn't you just tell us the truth? And they send Sarah and Abraham away. They lose the opportunity, Sarah and Abraham, to share the good news about the God of the universe with this unbelieving group of people. Now, what's even more amazing about the story, and some of you probably are familiar, is that 8 chapters later, it repeats itself. Abraham, they're in the nation of the Philistines, and Abraham says the same thing to the Philistines. She's my sister. He has Sarah tell this lie. And Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, is like, why didn't you just tell us the truth? And if you remember the story, Abraham is like, well, technically she kind of is my sister because she's my relative from this and that. No, he was deceptive. His intent was to mislead. It's not a good idea when the unbelievers are more committed to honesty than the believers. And that's kind of what happens in this exchange. And Abraham has planted the seed of deception in his family, and Sarah is a participant, and the seed begins to grow. Here's Genesis chapter 26. It says, now there was a famine in the land besides the earlier famine of Abraham's time, and Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. So it's a similar situation. It's a different famine. It's 60 years later. Isaac is now the one involved. And Abimelech, who is the son or the grandson of the one that Abraham had interacted with, is involved as well. And God says to Isaac, stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and your descendants, I will give all these lands and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. He affirms the promise with Isaac that he had given to Isaac's parents. And so Isaac stayed in Gerar, which is good. Good job, Isaac. That's what he told him to do. When the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, she is my sister. Because he was afraid to say, she is my wife. He thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebecca because she is beautiful. Now, I'm not sure what's going on with this family. Maybe they just had incredibly gorgeous women in their family. Maybe they just had a very inflated view of how attractive their women were. Maybe the women of these other cultures were just atrociously unattractive, and so anybody that walked, they would be excited. I don't know what the deal is, but what's happening here, again, is this idea of legacy that we talked about last week. Remember, legacy is simply the reality of what we leave behind. for those who follow in our footsteps. And you see here that Isaac, in the same situation, becomes who he saw Abraham become, or who he had heard about Abraham become years and years earlier. See, our kids and our grandkids are not going to become who we plan for them to be, or who we hope that they'll turn out to be, but they'll take their cues from what they observe in us. In other words, we can tell them something until we're blue in the face, but the biggest impact is what they experience. And this isn't just true in families, by the way. If you're a teacher or a coach or somebody who works with young people in any capacity, they are watching you. I can't remember just about anything that my teachers said in terms of the content of the classes I took when I was a kid, but I remember specific teachers and how they carried themselves and the way they were. And this is what happens here in Abraham's family. Isaac did what Abraham had done with just one little twist. Did you catch that? Abraham had asked Sarah to pretend. Isaac did the pretending for Rebekah. This woman is not who you think she is. He lies on her behalf. And I think we have to, by the way, I think we have to learn how to authentically engage the culture within our families, because otherwise it's extremely confusing to the people around us who are trying to figure out this whole Jesus thing. That's part of the story here. And then, if you know how it continues, this is where the thing just blows up out of control. Because if you remember from last week, Isaac and Rebekah have two sons, twin boys, the Yeti, Esau, and then they have Jacob. And Jacob's name, when it's translated into the English, there's a bunch of ways you can translate it. One of the words that it translates into is the word deceiver. It's almost like he's born into this thing. And he spends his life manipulating and maneuvering and trying to figure out, how can I become Esau? And it's with games and fooling and deception and lies. And if you remember last week, we talked about how he traded a bowl of soup for Esau's birthright. He sort of tricked and worked his way and maneuvered and got the birthright from Esau. This week he's after Esau's blessing. Now, blessing in their culture was a very, very powerful thing. It's difficult for us to fully understand, but this is the best way I can explain it to you. It's like if a dad, kind of towards the end of his life, would call his oldest son in and would take his oldest son by the sides of the face and look him right in the eye and would begin to weep and would say to his oldest son, "I want you to know something. I love you. I am so proud of you and the man that you have become. Watching you as dad, husband, with your work ethic and your faith, it's just so amazing what God has done in your life. And now I want you to go forward with my blessing. Everything I have is now you become the man that God has designed you." I mean, it's this kind of language of just incredible affirmation, approval. And at this point in the story, Esau is about to receive that because he's the oldest son, and it's driving Jacob crazy. Jacob wants this blessing. And here's the interesting part. It's Rebekah, Isaac's wife, who helps Jacob through deception. Here's Genesis 27. "Rebekah said to her son Jacob, 'Look, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of the Lord before I die.'" I kind of picture Rebekah has got like a glass up on the wall listening to this conversation between her husband and her oldest son. She overhears it. She, if you remember from last week, she loves Jacob more than she loves Esau. And so she has this, her go-to is, "I'm going to create a deception." And this is what she says. "Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me two choice young goats so I can prepare some tasty food for your father just the way he likes it. Then take it to your father to eat so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "But my brother Esau is He's a Yeti. And I'm afraid. I'm a man with smooth skin. I can't even, I got peach fuzz. He's not going to think that I'm Esau. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him. No, Jacob, you would actually be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing. His mother said to him, "My son, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. Go and get them for me." And so Rebecca makes this food, and she tells Jacob to dress up in his brother's clothes, and Isaac is deceived. He gives the blessing to Jacob instead of Esau. And the Bible says when they found out about Jacob's deception, it says that Isaac trembled violently, because husband-wife deception can be very devastating. And it says that Esau cried out with an exceedingly bitter cry. This deception has now become a default inside of their family, and there is emotion, painful consequences already. It's starting to blow up. And maybe you grew up like that. Maybe you live like that now, where your family has very little honest communication and lots of secrets and manipulation and maneuvering and trying to make sure things look okay, hoping no one will see that in essence you're living a lie or you're pretending. It's a horrible way for Jacob to grow up, believing that he has to fool his dad in order to receive approval from him. What an awful thing. Technically, he gets the blessing, but he has to pretend that he's somebody he's not in order to do so. And I think this is one of the reasons why Jacob struggles so much in his faith, his relationship with God, because of this confusing environment he grew up in with his parents. I know a ton of people like this who say, "I am a Christian," but they live as though God doesn't approve of them. And so they spend their whole life trying to earn blessings that they already have as Christ followers. And for Jacob, this thing, it just snowballs. It just keeps getting worse. Because his deception makes Esau so mad that Esau literally wants to kill him. And so Jacob, what does he do? He hides. Another kind of deception. He moves away. His mom and dad say, "Look, whatever you do, do not marry somebody like your brother who has been marrying women outside of the faith. Find a godly woman to marry." And so Jacob is searching as he's traveling for Laban and Laban's family. And you see there's Laban. He is Rebekah's brother. And so Jacob knows, if I find one of Laban's descendants, one of his daughters, to be my wife, then I know I'm going to be marrying a godly woman. And so he keeps traveling and asking strangers and hopes of finding Laban's family until finally one day he finds himself at a well with a bunch of shepherds, and they tell him, "Yes, we know Laban's family. In fact, they sometimes come here to water their sheep." And so Jacob is excited, and the story picks up in Genesis 29. "Look," Jacob said, "the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." While he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Now, I don't want to make too big of a deal about this, but did you see what happened there? Jacob is just kind of standing there, not offering to help. "Why aren't you guys watering your sheep?" Until Rachel shows up. And then he's rolling stones away. He's getting water out. He's trying to make this impression. And I think when we date somebody and that whole dynamic that happens, we're always going to get the very best version of that person they can possibly create for us, aren't we? There's this little bit, or in some cases, lot of deception that happens there. And Jacob is really pretending like he's somebody he's not. And it impresses Rachel, because they go back to Laban and they say, hey, we want to get married. Now, Laban, maybe because he was smart, or maybe this was just their culture, says, okay, you can marry Rachel if you agree to work for me for 7 years. Imagine that. You meet the woman that you want to get married to. You're 25, you're excited, you know, everything ready to go. And then just wait till you're 32 and work for her dad the whole time. And yet the Bible says that those 7 years, and this is a quote, seemed to Jacob but a few days because of his love for her. Oh, isn't that great? It's awesome. Yeah. Okay, Genesis 29. Sorry, I was excited about that. Story kind of takes a little bit of a turn here. It says, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Or in the Hebrew, that would be Rachel was hot. But when evening came, Laban, key verse here, but when evening came, Laban took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob. When the morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Laban replied, it is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Now, there's so much to say about this story, most of which I'm not going to say at this point. I mean, how does that even possibly happen? I don't know. But here's the deal. Every single person who gets married should prepare themselves for the day that they are going to wake up in the morning and realize that in some sense, this person that they're married to is not the person they thought they were marrying. That happens to all of us. In fact, you should prepare yourself for the fact that you are going to realize that about yourself. See, we can't, in that kind of constant presence with another person, we can't maintain the deception for very long. We're all pretending. Now, apparently in the family of Rebekah and Laban, honesty wasn't too big of a priority on their list. I'm not sure what the deal is here with Laban. Why didn't he just tell Jacob, look, somebody needs to marry Leah before I'm letting Rachel get married. Either you or we're going to find somebody else, but I'm not letting, I don't know why he chose to deceive, but that's what he did. What we do know is the deceiver ends up being deceived here. And look at what happens to Jacob. That's not where you want to be. Now he's got four wives who are all trying to manipulate, maneuver, deceive all around him. And somewhere Esau, I think, has to be laughing at all this, right? I mean, it's interesting, by the way, that Esau is the only one in their family about whom there isn't recorded in the Bible a deception that he initiated. And you know the rest of the story. We talked about it last week. Jacob has 12 boys. 10 of them are jealous of the 11th, and so they sell him into slavery. And how do they respond when confronted? If you remember Donny Osmond, they lie. They say, well, no, they dip the coat in the blood, and they say, no, an animal killed him. He's died. And they deceive, and they have this whole scheme. And even Joseph, when he goes down to Egypt at the end of the story, and he wants to bring Benjamin, his younger brother, and his father down as well, and his older brothers refuse, his response is to use deception. See, it went viral in their family. It became one of their default responses. It affected their ability to share their faith with the culture, and it just absolutely created incredible turmoil, confusion within their family. The more they tried to use it, the worse it got. Now, for us today, my question is, where do you recognize yourself in this story? Perhaps you regularly face the temptation to deceive. Maybe you've had deception in your past, and even though it's been uncovered, you're still feeling the weight of its consequences. Or maybe, in some sense, as you sit here today, your life is pretend. It's a lie. and you feel trapped and afraid, and you can't imagine something worse that could possibly happen than for that whole thing to be uncovered, for people to know. You can't let go of the deception because you might believe maybe that it's the only way thing that's protecting you from the consequences. It's like you're a slave, and deception is your master. Now, I'd love to be able to stand up in front of you this morning and say, okay, here's the deal. All right, ready? Just stop doing that. No more deception. And I don't think that's necessarily bad advice, that avoiding or learning strategies for resisting the temptation to deceive, that's a good step, I think. Resisting a lie, I do think that's a key step for us. In those moments when we're actually facing that temptation, you know, I've noticed in the last several weeks as I've been thinking about this and preparing this message, all the time for me, the instinct, the desire to protect myself and maneuver and pretend, it just raises up inside of me. And it was last week as I was working on this message, actually, I went to take a break, I got in my car, and then you see the lights of the police car behind you. And I know my first instinct was how can I tell him something that will make him believe that whatever he thinks I did didn't actually happen? You know what I mean? Okay, well, what's he stopping? I didn't even really know. Or maybe it was because I ran through it was a red light. And so I'm just trying to, we get into those moments and how are we going to respond? But there's more to it than just figuring out how to resist the lie. I didn't get a ticket, by the way. It's a heart issue. It really is. It's a faith issue. And here is the good news. Jesus in John chapter 14 said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. Truth is a man named Jesus Christ. And he didn't come to make us slaves, but to set us free. Maybe you've heard this quote from Jesus in John 8. It says, if you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Now, maybe you've heard that. Are you aware of the context? Read John 8 sometime. There's a woman there who's living a lie. She's gotten herself into this series of very unhealthy relationships, and she's probably ashamed and terrified and feeling hopeless. And against her will, she gets dragged out in front of Jesus and in front of this whole crowd of people, and her life is completely exposed. Her worst fear is realized, because when this thing gets uncovered, her deception, in their culture, the penalty is death. What she probably does not realize is that she is standing face to face with the truth. She is looking at the God of the universe. And when you get face to face with Jesus, lies are exposed. And I think as gospel families, or as the goal we have there, one of the things that we have to do is create safe environments inside of our home for truth telling. Even when there might be consequences or it might be uncomfortable, it has to be okay between husband, wife, and kids and parents and each other for truth to be okay, a safe environment there. Because that will help us not to be self-deceivers or to try to deceive God, which is a ridiculous notion anyway. Remember the story? Jesus says, he who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw the stone at her. In other words, Jesus is going, she's not the only deceiver in this crowd. Everyone here is a liar. And I could say the same thing about all of us who are here today. And I'm not being flip or meaning to offend. It's just true. The toothpaste is already out of the tube for all of us. We cannot approve ourselves. That's the whole message of the gospel. That's why we need Jesus. Look at what he says next. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older ones first, because they're the ones who are most aware. Yep. Yeah. I don't fit here. Until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there, Jesus straightened up and he asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." In that moment, the promise that Jesus made came true in the life of this woman. The truth did set her free. And there's no way that when she showed up in front of Jesus in that crowd that she thought there was freedom on the other side of that. There is no way. All she could think about was how horrible this circumstance was. And it will be the same for you. If are you willing to get face to face with Jesus? He is the truth, and exposure to the truth is key. It's as important, I think even more important, than resisting the lie. I was reading this blog, a guy by the name of Tim Challies, and he had read about this illustration that has to do with banks and how they train their tellers to discern whether money is real or counterfeit. And he was skeptical about this. He had heard this illustration a while that what they do, that banks will only allow their trainees to see the real thing. They'll only expose them to actual dollar, you know, real dollar bills. They won't let them see any of the counterfeit stuff. That by exposing them only to the actual stuff, they'll know when they're seeing something fake. And so he's from Canada, and so he went to the Bank of Canada and spent a day with the people who do this training, and he found out that's exactly how they do it. And his conclusion was the same thing that we're talking about here is the more exposure that we have to what's real, the more the lies will not find a place. They'll be pushed to the side. Exposure to the truth is key. And that's the text that we just read there where Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching," God has given us the word of truth. He has filled us as Christ followers with the spirit of truth. And the more time we have in his word face to face with Jesus, the more we are going to trust him. Our minds and our hearts will become more conformed to the truth. And then we will know the truth. And the truth will set us free. God, we are so thankful, again, for Abraham's family in the fact that despite really this pattern of sin and destructive behavior in their lives, you still use them to be a huge impact on the world. And that gives us hope. Thank you for Jesus, that he does completely cover our sins, that we don't need to use deception or jealousy to protect ourselves, to cover for ourselves, to pretend and help us together within our families and our life groups and this as our church family to sort of figure out how we can continue to pursue the truth. A man named Jesus, and it's in his name that we pray. Amen.